Today I'll be talking about COPD challenges, and we all know that COPD is a major cause of morbidity and mortality. It has a very strong, substantial burden that's both increasing and substantially important. We know that COPD prevalence is on the rise. There is over 329 million people suffering COPD all over the world, the majority of which suffer from shortness of breath at least twice a week. Over 75% of these patients experience sudden deterioration of their symptoms, what we call exacerbations, and about 75% of these patients have limited ability to carry out routine everyday tasks, such as going to work or walking upstairs. In the year 2012, about 3 million people died from COPD. Today, COPD is the fourth major cause of death, and it is projected to be the third in the year 2020. I was fortunate enough to witness the development of the GOLD guidelines since the early of this century. I've been a member of the GOLD Assembly for more than 10 years, and the aim of the 2017 update is to provide an unbiased review of the current evidence for assessment, diagnosis, and treatment of patients with COPD that can aid the clinician. The objective of the update is not only directed towards relieving patient symptoms and its impact on their lives, but also to reduce risk of adverse events that may affect the patient at some points in the future. This emphasizes that physicians should focus on both short-term and long-term protection of their patients. Well, we all know that COPD is an inflammatory disease and is characterized by systemic inflammation. And after months and days of conflict, the GOLD guideline came with a very simplified definition, a common preventable and treatable disease that is characterized by persistent symptoms, and that airflow limitation that is due to airway and alveolar abnormalities caused by significant exposure to noxious particles or gases. If you compare this definition to the one which held by GOLD from 2011 to 16, we'll see that two words have been removed from this definition. One of them is inflammation, and the second is exacerbation and comorbidities. And nobody doubts in this room that exacerbations and comorbidities are the main contributors to the overall severity in individual patients. Also, the term inflammation is very important to remind us again that there is a pathology in these patients that we have to work on more hard to reach a better control. So, COPD is characterized by airway inflammation, besides some irreversible components that is led by the inflammation, and that is fibrosis, luminal plugs, or loss of alveolar attachments with decrease in the elastic recoil. No doubt that cigarette smoke is the major risk for COPD patients, but as the previous speakers have outlined, that indoor and outdoor air pollution can also share in this problem. Other forms of tobacco smoke, occupational dust, or chemicals can contribute. Maybe genetic predisposition in some patients. Yes, we have one example, the alpha-1 antitrypsin deficiency, though not common, but it is a perfect example to show how the gene can interact with the environment to produce a very severe pan-SNR pathology in the patients with COPD. Perhaps infections, viral infections, especially infections during childhood, compromising the lung health during that period of time, maybe bacterial, maybe mycobacterial. Tuberculosis is now recognized as a risk factor for COPD. Poor socioeconomic status, and perhaps also aging population. The patients are living longer now, so that they are more and more exposed to risk factor for COPD. One of the important things that was not mentioned in the GOLD since its beginning is that water pipe smoking was not a cause of COPD. And fortunately enough, we could introduce this in 2017. It's a collaborative work between six countries in our region, because we are the ones who are endemically infested with the shisha smoke and the water pipe smoking. This work was done by Gunan from Turkey, myself from Egypt, Nemati from Iran, Gobain from Saudi Arabia, El Materi from Kuwait, and Zinaoun from Lebanon. And it led this GOLD 2017 To quote, water pipe smoking is a risk factor for COPD, and it is referenced as reference 68 in chapter 1. I'll go quickly through the changes that we have witnessed during the gold development. And since the beginning of this century, gold has been calling the pulmonary function as being the denominator or the more important factor that leads treatment. And we know that these gold stages, and when I say stages, I don't say steps like in asthma. Steps, you can go up and down. But stages means patient is progressively worsening from 1, 2, 3, 4 building until he goes to heaven or die. Quite depressive decline and quite depressive outcome. Then in 2011, with the ECLIPSE studies and many other studies, it was shown that FEV1 did not correlate with the patient-centered outcome. The patient is more concerned with his dyspnea, exercise, symptoms, and exacerbations. And so it came up with this ABCD algorithm. But unfortunately, this had too many variables and too many alternatives and treatment that make the physician dazzling how to follow this very difficult and complex algorithm. In 2017, by removing the pulmonary function from day-to-day care, of course, pulmonary function is needed for the diagnosis and assessment of limitation, but the day-to-day care can be done only by simply symptoms and exacerbation. This proved to be better. So with earlier stages of gold, as I said, this decline in lung function, progressive decline, used to be the denominator which decides which the treatment the patient should receive, and it looks like a roller coaster. You go down, you don't go up again. And this was modeled by the Fletcher, the famous Fletcher and Pitot curve, which now we celebrate 40 years of this elegant paper from the British Medical Journal, which shows that the patient is always progressing until he dies. In the 2011 algorithm, as I said, too many variables, pulmonary functions, exacerbations, symptoms, CAT, and dyspnea scores. And then when you put the treatment, we have different options, primary options, first choice treatment, and second choice treatment. This was very confusing to physicians, and many people did not follow with that. But with the refined ABCD assessment tool done in 2017, we do spirometry because spirometry is a must to do to confirm the diagnosis, and we assess the airflow limitation. But then with day-to-day care, we assess the symptoms by the CAT score or the modified Research Council index for dyspnea. On the y-axis, we measure the exacerbations so that we get a more simple view. With the A, we have low symptom. It's like now not a four-story building. It's like a two-story building with two apartments. In the first floor, you have low risk. The apartment on the right is for high symptoms, and on the left is for low symptoms. And in the higher, on the second floor, you have high-risk patients, either with high symptoms or low symptoms. I'll give you an example of how did it change our view in our initiating treatment. Ali is a 55-year-old male patient with an FEV1 less than 50%, CAT 25, high, and had 3 exacerbations last year. I think when you look at this model, you would say this is clearly a case of a D, whether it is from the previous guidelines or from the update. But his friend Sammy, who have the same age group, 55 years, has the same FEV1 less than 50%, the same CAT score, but didn't have any exacerbation last year. Where should we put Sammy? I think with the new guidelines, in the older guidelines, he should be put also D, but in the newer guidelines, he should be a B patient. He should be treated with a grade B recommendation. So a proposed model for initiation and subsequent escalation, and for the first time, GOLD says de-escalation of pharmacologic management of COPD according to individualized assessment of symptoms and exacerbation risk, putting in mind reduction of symptom and reducing future risk, that's exacerbation, disease progression, and mortality. And it comes up with only one, no primary and secondary alternatives algorithm. And they put the green bar on the choice with the more evidence. So GOLD is putting all the choices correct, but put in green the one which weighs more as evidence is concerned. So in A category, we start with a bronchodilator and then evaluate the effect. Continue, stop, or try alternative class of bronchodilator later. If the patient is of group B and group B has low risk and at the same time he has more symptoms, we start with a LABA or LAMA. If still he has persistent symptoms, we can combine LABA and LAMA. And you will notice that those patients with low risk, Gold does not recommend the use of ICS or inhaled corticosteroids. For group C, you can start with a LAMA, and if persistent symptoms, you can shift either to a LABA ICS or to a LAMA LABA. And again, and this will be subject to phenotypic variations of these exacerbations and type of patients, as was mentioned in this morning. In group D, it is recommended to start with a LABA LAMA, or you may start with a LAMA alone and shift to LABA LAMA if the patient was not improved, or you may start with a LABA ICS and shift to LAMA LABA, and again, this will be subject to the phenotypic variation of the patient because not all the patients and not all one fits all category. If the patient had further exacerbation, you can go up to triple therapy, and if the patient is controlled, you can go down to either LAMA LABA or LABA ICS. If the patient still has further exacerbation and the patient has chronic bronchitis, you consider roflumilast. And if the patient has a history of smoking, consider also macrolide in the treatment. And that's the algorithm for the group D patients. Now, about the challenges, the first challenge I want to talk about is the combination of LABA-LAMA, because this has been focused in the recent versions of the GOLD and recent publications since the FLAME study that was evolved in last May. This provided a very important concept, the concept of dual bronchodilatation in prevention of exacerbations and improving lung function. There have been studies on another molecule, the umeclidinium vilanterol, demonstrated significant improvement of the TRAF FEV1 by 167 milliliters versus placebo. And over these individual components, umeclidinium vilanterol improved the lung function by 167 over the 52 over the umeclidinium alone, or 72 milliliter, 95 milliliter over the vilanterol alone. Another study was published back in 2015 by Maliki Yazdi. He shown that umeclidinium vilanterol was superior over tiotropium in terms of it's a meta-analysis in terms of prevention of exacerbations. And the combination was used in a simply used device, the Ellipta device, shows statistically significant improvement in the lung function, TRAF FEV1 and versus tiotropium in maintenance naive patients at week 24. The benefit of this combination versus tiotropium was greater in the maintenance naive population when compared to the overall study population. The second challenge I want to mention about is the role of steroids in asthma and COPD. In asthma, there is no problem in appreciating that asthma steroids are targeted treatment to inflammatory cells like eosinophils, mast cells, and CD4 cells. So there is no question that asthma, that ICS is the cornerstone management in asthma patients. And no patient with asthma can live with or can be treated with a long-acting bronchodilator without ICS. In COPD, it's quite different because the cells here are neutrophils, macrophages, and CD8 cells traditionally mentioned. And these cells have variable responses to ICS. So the results vary because ICS may affect some cells involved in the inflammatory pathway, but not others. In older studies, there were weak data to support correlations between inflammatory cells, mediators, and clinical outcomes. The variability in responses reflects the heterogeneity of our COPD patients. And the prevention of exacerbation can also vary based on the exacerbation phenotype. So study into this different COPD and exacerbation phenotypes can provide a better answer. 6 years ago, one of the early studies on the exacerbation phenotypes done by Mona Bafadel, this elegant study have divided the exacerbation COPD into four subgroups or so four phenotypes. One we call bacterial exacerbations with sputum IL-1 is a biomarker. eosinophil predominant with increase in the peripheral eosinophils, viral predominant exacerbations with the biomarker CXCL10, and the post-inflammatory, which does not show increase in its inflammatory cells. And what she showed is that the eosinophil predominant phenotype was the most responsive to corticosteroid treatment than the other phenotypes. So perhaps not all the COPD will respond to the ICS in the same manner. This was substantiated by a post hoc analysis suggested by Pascoe et al. and was published in The Lancet a couple of years ago, and which showed that the use of fluticasone furoate with velantorol, and here fluticasone furoate used at a low dose compared to the treatment with velantorol alone in patients with eosinophilic exacerbations with a threshold of 2% or more change, there was much more significant improvement with the combination therapy than in patients who had not this eosinophilic exacerbation. So this substantiated the concept that eosinophilic exacerbation is better treated by an ICS LABA. So what about the literature in ICS LABA in general? Two independent large Cochrane meta-analyses were done comparing ICS LABA versus placebo on one hand. This was seven studies, including about 7,495 patients. And the steroids here were fluticasone propionate salmeterol combination or budesonide formeterol combination. On the other study, which included 9,921, these nine studies also included fluticasone propionate salmeterol or budesonide formeterol. And the other one was versus LABA. It showed around 25% reduction of exacerbation rate when we use the ICS LABA versus LABA alone. This tells us that ICS can be very important in reducing COPD exacerbation frequency. This is a pooled analysis during the phase 3 trials. It's a sum of two large studies, and it was done by Dransfield and published in The Lancet a couple of years ago, using the fluticasone velantorol 100 versus the velantorol alone, and it showed 30% reduction of exacerbation frequency in patients who used the combination, the Relvar fluticasone velantorol combination. If we add this to the simplicity of the device, and yesterday Dr. Omar Osmani have said that it is very important to select a device it is as important as selecting the treatment itself. The Ellipta device has been ranked among the highest in the patient preference because it's very easy to use, and the medication has a true 24-hour efficacy of long duration. So if you combine the efficacy of the treatment with this device, it is a challenge to hypothesize that true clinical value and effectiveness of the fluticasone velantorol will be most evident when studied in randomized controlled trials with an open-label design conducted in a normal care setting of everyday clinical practice. So after proving efficacy and safety in phase 3 studies, and again in the proving efficacy and safety in patients with COPD with cardiovascular comorbidities, it came the time to judge what about the efficacy of salmeterol, the newcomer of inhaled corticosteroid with velantorol, in a real-life setting. And this was the Salford Lung Study. Salford Lung Study was done by Jürgen Westbo. Jürgen Westbo is the previous chair of the GOLD Scientific Committee and one of the principal investigators of the FLAME study. He is the first author in this particular study, and it's about real-life studies. Just a quick history about this. In 2008, a pan-European group of expert physicians, politicians, and patients conducted a summit meeting at the European Parliament to address unmet needs in disease management. They start talking about asthma and then COPD, and they came up with the following recommendation: that the evidence from real-world studies should be incorporated into guidelines. Randomized controlled clinical trial patients may not represent typical patients seen in everyday clinical practice. The inclusion of real-world data that explore a wide range of patients and endpoints should allow clinicians to make more informed treatment decisions. And they decided for funding of these real-world trials Such studies can guide management of asthma and COPD in many patients and provide a wider insight into comorbidities. So whereas in randomized controlled studies, they look into efficacy, they looked at a controlled environment with very strict exclusion and inclusion criteria, real-world studies look at more important thing is effectiveness in a real-world setting with everyday patient. I wouldn't say that real-world studies should replace randomized controlled studies, but I think it is quite complementary because we know that real-world studies don't have a control arm in them. So these are complementary in order to plan for future guidelines. I take this example. This patient, 45 years of age, body mass index 33, smokes half pack day for 15 years. That's about 7.5 pack per year, and sometimes water pipes. His post-bronchodilator FEV1 over FVC is 66, he's a COPD patient, and his post-bronchodilator FEV1 is 65% predicted, not mentioned in most of the randomized as an exclusion criteria in most controlled trials. Diagnosis was COPD with daily symptoms of cough, leg and shortness of breath, night awakening, cough 3 to 4 times a week, and current treatment is labetalbumin and ventolin. When this patient comes to me and said, "Doctor, can you help me with your guidelines?" I would say, "Sorry, sir, you are not in my evidence-based guideline. I cannot treat you." That's why we have to look further into including the guidelines these types of patients, not to exclude not only studies that has based on strict exclusion criteria of patients, so to avoid bias. So with the sulfur study, it was a focus on effectiveness in measuring medicine impact under close to normal conditions. It was non-selective, including a broad and inclusive patient population, which varied in lifestyles and comorbidities. The question in the sulfur study was, how effective is initiating treatment with once daily fluticasone vilanterol 92 over 22 at the 100 microgram Relvar compared with the continuing treatment with the usual care patients with COPD. So the study design was about 2,802 patients were treated in the primary care, diagnosed by their GPs as COPD patients, and were using the various combinations that we give to our patients, LABAs, LAMAs, ICS, you can name. One arm are left with this usual care, and in the other arm was initiated with fluticasone vilanterol, the newcomer of the fluticasone generation, with 100 microgram, the lower dose, in an open label. And the study was done for 12 months, during which the patient had regular visits or at least 3 phone calls, and at the end he was received again with a checkup, a CAT score, a spirometry to measure the outcome. So what was the usual care used in this sulfur study? About 14% were non-ICS taking patients, the LABA, LAMA, or LABA-LABA, and about 86 had an ICS component, whether it was a seretide, Symbicort, or whichever was the patient using at that time, or preferred by the primary care physician. And the primary care physician can adjust his treatment during the year depending on the demands of his patient. This is the study population, and you can see in both arms, the post-bronchodilator FEV1 on both arms did not differ. The CAT score also is similar. If you look also at the mean number of exacerbation during the last year, it was quite close. Well, what are the results? The results have shown an 8.4 relative reduction in the rate of moderate to severe exacerbations in patients using the fluticasone vilanterol once daily compared to the usual care medicine. If it is compared to patients who are using already an ICS-containing device or treatment, it was an 8% relative rate reduction, which was significant. The NNT, the number of, needed to treat was 7, meaning that one additional moderate to severe exacerbations can be prevented in every 7 patients treated with an fluticasone furoate vilanterol compared with twice daily ICS LABA over the 12 months. More patients reported improvement in their health status in both quality of life and in their symptoms as measured or assessed by the CAT score, about 30% improvement on the Relvar FF Velanterol once daily combination. And the safety, though there has been some adverse events of pneumonia, but the differences between the usual care arm and the fluticasone furoate Velanterol was not significant. And remember that with the usual care, there were many patients not using an ICS. They were using a LAMA-LABA or a LAMA or a LABA alone. The third challenge I want to go into is, can ICS be withdrawn safely in COPD patients? This came from a study called the Optimo study that looked at withdrawal of ICS in COPD patients who did not have an increased risk of exacerbation. These are patients with mild COPD, did not have frequent exacerbation. And the results shown that you can safely withdraw ICS in those patients with infrequent exacerbation without altering the outcome. Again, we don't need ICS in low-risk patients. Then came the Wisdom study. In the Wisdom study, studied more severe and more frequent exacerbators. And this was a study showing patients with a triple combination, tiotropium, salmeterol, and fluticasone. And this was fluticasone propionate, the Seretide 500. And they tried to put one arm with the triple combination, and in the other arm, they removed the fluticasone, so the patient remained on the LABA-LAMA alone. At the end of the study, they have shown that withdrawal of the ICS did not increase the risk of moderate to severe exacerbation in patients with severe COPD. But on the next page, look what happens. The FEV1 significantly was reduced if you withdraw the ICS. So this is quite confusing. You are not decreasing the exacerbation, but you are losing a hell of a significant amount of milliliters, over maybe 30 or 40 milliliters of FEV1 in these patients. And you will not understand what is the importance of a reduction of an FEV1 of more than 40 milliliters unless you have a COPD, and you will see how does it impact your daily activities and lives. So low-risk COPD patients can safely withdraw ICS from their therapy. Patients with COPD with moderate to severe disease and frequent exacerbation may harm from ICS withdrawal. In some patients, ICS LABA may be the first choice. These are patients who may have features suggestive of asthma and COPD overlap. So if you want to withdraw the ICS from your patient, you have to make sure 100%, I say 100%, he does not have an asthmatic component in this situation. Otherwise, it would be very drastic to the patient. Again, you can be also guided by the presence of high blood eosinophilic count or an increase of 2% eosinophil during exacerbations, which makes him, according to most of the studies, it is a very important biomarker for response to ICS. Some other messages I would go quickly with the 20 brief messages in the 2017 update. That drugs used for primary pulmonary hypertension are not helpful in pulmonary hypertension due to COPD. Theophylline, it's very commonly used in my country. I don't know the situation in Lebanon. It's not recommended in COPD except in countries with little access to LABAs and LAMAs. Safety of e-cigarettes is uncertain because people go on with the e-cigarettes as if they are not smoking. Anti-TNF have little benefit and increase harm to COPD patients. And statins was once advocated to reduce exacerbations in COPD. Now we know that statins does not prevent COPD exacerbations. Remember that COPD is a systemic disease, and there is a lot of comorbidities that we have to look for in every COPD patient concerning several organs, cardiovascular, metabolic, diabetes, gastrointestinal, hematologic, psychic, orthopedic, osteoporosis, etc. And so it's a call that whenever I see a COPD patient, I should always look for comorbidity, and I also advise my colleagues in the cardiology department, in the gastroenterology, in the diabetology, whenever they see a patient who is smoking, they should look for COPD for early detection. So to summarize the COPD debate I have just mentioned today, in randomized controlled trials, LABA-LAMA was superior to ICS-LABA in reducing COPD exacerbation, supporting the role of dual bronchodilatation. This was very nicely demonstrated by a randomized controlled trial like the FLAME. In real-world setting, fluticasone furoate is a newcomer with the vilanterol, the Relvar 100, proved more effective than usual care in reducing exacerbation with a once-daily, easy-to-use device, and it's a call to include more of these real-world studies in order to include more patients that we see in our practice, not those with the strictly biased criteria inclusion and exclusion. Patients with higher blood eosinophil count have more frequent exacerbation and gain greater benefits when they are treated with ICS LABAs than with any other combination. ICS can be withdrawn in some patients with COPD, but in others can be harmful, reducing lung function and increasing risk of exacerbation. And finally, ICS cannot be withdrawn from COPD patients with asthma features, the ECHO. So we don't talk about ECHOs because there is no such thing called ECHOs, but if the patient has asthma features, you should be very, very reluctant to withdraw his ICS. By end of my talk, whenever I talk about guidelines, these are evidence-based documents. And when I had once chat with Jorgen Vestbo, and I criticized things about the gold, and he answered to me, sorry, Hisham, this is not a guideline. This is an evidence-based document. It's not a holy book. And when whoever is a person who is treated by the book is likely to die of a misprint. Thank you for listening.
Thank you, Professor Tarraf, for this extensive overview on COPD treatment. Is there any question?
In my personal experience and view, because I come from a developing poor country, it's not like they're talking the West. Literature say theophylline has a very narrow therapeutic margin. It has many drug-to-drug interaction, has many side effects, particularly in children that shouldn't be written. In my own experience, adding on theophylline to treatment with for COPD patients can be beneficial. The problem is theophylline does not have a strong pharmaceutical firm to defend, and there is lot of literature of how theophylline can reduce exacerbation on its own. But there is a lot of work done by Peter Barnes and colleagues that small doses of theophylline can revive the steroid responsiveness in COPD patients. And this has been published in several ways. But this is not as if you are giving theophylline as a bronchodilator, something equivalent to 100 milligram per day, as if you give aspirin as an antiplatelet effect. If you give 500 milligram aspirin, you spoil this effect. So if you give very small doses of theophylline, together with an ICS LABA, you enhance the ICS responsiveness, particularly in those who have resistance to ICS. Thank you.
If you want to defend the offer, you can add the idea that it increases transdiaphragmatic pressure for the COPDers, decreasing the concavity of the diaphragm and thus improving cough and improving vital capacity, specifically patients who are borderline to be extubated off the respirator. And I'd like to add two comments, if I may, that in the systemic disease in smoking, as we saw this morning, it can cause myopathy in the lower extremities and difficulty in walking, especially in the proximal muscles. The last idea of decreasing exacerbations, we found out in a study that has not yet been published, that all COPD patients discharged from hospital should be seen within 7 days of discharge so that exacerbation will be reduced by a specialist and not by their GP.
Yes. I agree totally. Thank you very much for this valuable comments. And it is very important. I consider always exacerbations in asthma, exacerbations in COPD is a fault of treatment, and we don't want to make the mistake twice or three times. So as you have mentioned, when I look into an exacerbation, I try to study what was the force which driven this exacerbation to occur. Was it because the patient was lack on controller treatment? He wasn't taking any controller. He was taking very mild medication. Then we adjust this by giving something to prevent the exacerbation. And for that, I think this is very important, because if we see patients in our region applying the gold recommendation by using a LABA ICS on a regular basis, they are very few. They are not taking it as they should. perhaps also the expenses of the medication is. But again, the expense of the exacerbation, the hospital admission, and the loss of days in work is should count as well.
Thank you for your excellent lecture. We know that increasing the fluticasone flow rate from 100 to 200 in COPD will increase the risk of pneumonia. But what about Vilanterol? Is there any safe dose range if the patient accidentally increased the number of puffs?
What about Vilanterol?
Yeah, yes. Any risk of arrhythmia?
Okay, first part of the question, the fluticasone flow rate, there has been two doses studied. One is the 100 and one is the 200 micrograms. Both were unequivocally equal in reducing the exacerbations of COPD when given with the Vilanterol combination. But the one with the 200 had a higher risk of pneumonia. So it produced larger number of pneumonia, which was significant than the 100. That's why we don't recommend the high dose of fluticasone, Vilanterol, Relvar in the 200 in COPD patients. We recommend them as 100, leave the 200 for the more immune patients or more immune protected, the asthmatic patients, not the COPD. For COPD, it's only 100. The optimal dose for Vilanterol is 25 micrograms twice daily, and the patient should restrict himself once daily. So the patient should not exceed these limits, because with any other labas, if you exceed the dose, you may have risk of some side effects like cardiovascular side effects and so on. So this is the recommended dose of Vilanterol. And the synergism with both will allow them to be effective if they are given in combination once daily dose.
Doctor, yes. When we decide to add roflumilast to the treatment of our COPD patient or macrolide, and we know that macrolide will be for a short time of like 3 months, 4 months. Roflumilast can be for the same time or for long life or whatever.
Roflumilast is an orally administered anti-inflammatory that should be given on a regular basis. When it came more than 10 years ago, there was very high expectation about this anti-neutrophilic agent and it will control. But time told us that the drug did not meet the expectation, and it is only reserved for those who did not respond to the ICS, LABA, or LAMA combinations. It's left only for, if you try everything, this is a good add-on therapy. But it is not option now in the introduction, and you can see its place in the goal 27 has been far behind this.
So when you start roflumilast, you don't stop it?
No, add-on. I give roflumilast, we prescribe roflumilast in those who already taken the triple combination ICS, LABA, LAMA, and did not respond, and they still has further exacerbations and coughing and so on. So an add-on with roflumilast can help the patient's symptoms a little bit, but cannot replace. If it, the question is to replace the ICS, LABA, or the LAMA, LABA with roflumilast, I don't think Gold have this recommendation.